I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to continue our conversation about the tragic challenge of Hoosiers who are addicted to opioids. We'll talk about how hard the road to recovery can be for them and the obstacles that are placed in their paths as they try to cover that ground. My guests are Jake Harper of Side Effects and WFYI, Dr. Andy Chambers of Indiana University's Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarne, Fairbanks Medical Director. Please join this important conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today, continuing our conversation about opioid addiction in Indiana. Particularly, we're going to focus on the struggle people have on the road to recovery and some obstacles that are in their way. If you'd like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Jake Harper, who is WFYI Side Effects reporter, who has reported on this issue extensively, Dr. Andy Chambers, who is with the Indiana University Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarne, who is medical director for Fairbanks Nonprofit Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center. Welcome to all of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you all here. I think probably, though, for people to understand exactly what's at stake here in dealing with this issue, Jake's done a story, I think, that lays out exactly what the stakes are very, very clearly and what the obstacles are that people find in getting the help they need on the path to recovery. So before we dive into the conversation, I think it probably would be wise to listen to that story.
These are the films. They also have the pill.
Twice a day, Angela and Nate Turner each unwrap a tiny strip that looks almost like colored scotch tape and put it under their tongues.
Just like one of them Listerine strips kind of you put in your mouth, but they taste disgusting.
But Angela says it's worth it. That strip is actually a drug called Suboxone. The Turners both got addicted to painkillers after injuries several years ago. And this year, they decided to go into recovery. Suboxone helps them control their cravings.
And you feel normal.
So you can function.
Yeah, you can function. But you're not high. It's like a miracle drug, really, it is.
Angela can take care of their 3-year-old daughter, and Nate can keep a job. But getting started on Suboxone took time. Angela says she had to wait 3 days to get her prescription filled, which put her into withdrawals.
Laying in bed, going through cold sweats, hot sweats, diarrhea.
For Nate, the wait was 5 days. On day 3, he relapsed and used heroin.
I swore to myself I was done. And then when I went back to having to use it, I just thought it was over, that I wasn't going to make it back to the program.
Suboxone is covered through the Turner's health plan, which is part of Indiana's Medicaid. But before their insurance company will pay for it, their doctor has to get approval, known as a PA, prior authorization. The process frustrates Andy Chambers, an addiction psychiatrist in Indianapolis.
And this will include, you know, phone calls, filling out forms, sometimes writing essays, going through appeal processes.
He says his nurses spend about 30 hours a week on all this.
It's almost like when you take on a patient to treat opiate addiction, you also have to take on another patient called the insurance company.
Getting a prior authorization can take days or weeks, depending on the drug and the insurance company. And for some insurers, a PA can expire after just a few months. PA requirements can also pressure doctors to change how they prescribe. Sometimes an insurer will push for a lower dosage than the doctor wants, or it'll require the doctor to wean a patient off of a medication in 12 months when the doctor thinks the patient needs more time.
These rules and regulations for us completely block the correct provision of care. And that's crazy.
Indiana Medicaid has started to allow some doctors to skip the back and forth with the insurance company, but Chambers says that hasn't helped him much yet. Sam Musinski of the American Psychiatric Association says PA delays leave patients vulnerable.
You may lose that opportunity right then and there. They may never come back.
He and other experts I spoke with say the use of prior authorizations for addiction medications is widespread in the U.S. As of 2013, Medicaid in 48 states required a PA to prescribe buprenorphine, the active ingredient in Suboxone.
It's just totally unfair. There's a continuing pattern of discrimination which results in reduced access to people who need opioid addiction treatment.
Musinski says insurers use PAs more often with mental health and addiction treatments than they do with other medical treatments. For instance, under the Turner's plan, insulin for diabetes doesn't require a prior authorization, but Suboxone does. Nate Turner managed to stay in treatment despite the prior authorization process. In fact, he says there's an irony here.
If I was on regular pain medicine, I'd be able to get him, no problem. No questions asked.
He says he got started on opioids without a prior authorization. He doesn't think he should need one to help him stop. Jake Harper, Side Effects Public Media.
Yeah, that was Jake Harper of WFYI and Side Effects reporting on a difficult road to recovery for people who are suffering from opioid addiction. And that is what we are talking about today on No Limits. It's about the difficulties along that road to recovery. Jake, I'm going to start by asking, how did you find the Turners?
I found the Turners through another addiction doctor, basically. I called and asked him if he had anyone that had experienced these kinds of delays with prior authorizations, and he was kind enough to sort of reach out to them and ask them if they were willing to talk to me, and they said yes.
And how did you get tuned into doing this story? What made you first aware that this was an issue?
That actually came from Dr. Chambers here, who's also in the studio with us.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to go there a little bit. I was going to, and I guess this makes it for a good segue. Dr. Chambers, how many people are there like the Turners who are sort of caught in, I mean, I'm probably going to be dating myself here by referring to what sounds like almost a perfect catch-22 situation where you can get yourself into the problem, but you're not allowed to get yourself back out?
If you mean in Indiana, thousands and thousands of people in the state of Indiana. Nationwide, there may be millions.
Okay. Do we have documentation on that anywhere? Or
We do know approximately the rates of opioid addiction in Indiana nationwide. It's a little bit of a fuzzy figure to figure out because, you know, so many people with opioid addiction, in fact, the majority are addicted to prescription opioids. Mm-hmm. And meaning that, you know, at some point or another, they were prescribed. So, the healthcare system itself, unfortunately, contributed to causing the addiction, so it's hard for the healthcare system to kind of own up and also diagnose many of those same people with addiction. So there's a little bit of a, you know, challenge there in diagnosing this. You know, if it was a disease that wasn't caused by the healthcare system, it'd be much easier to separate that out and, you know, define the exact numbers. It's also a moving target. You know, the number of people with this illness, has been climbing and climbing, so it's not static.
So, Dr. Mangiacarne, can you give me and our listeners a definition or some examples of what would be considered an opioid?
There are many things that are considered opioids. Medications such as oxycodone, Percocet, OxyContin, morphine, fentanyl, any of these class of medications that are primarily used to treat acute and chronic pain would fall into the opioid category.
And how does someone get into the position that the Turners did? Presumably they had, and Jake, I'll ask you, do you know their backstory? I mean, what was the chronic pain or pain situation that they were dealing with that led to the addiction?
Yeah, sure. So Angela, who you heard there, was she had an accident in the kitchen. I believe it was a grease fire. And so she was injured, essentially ended up in the hospital and was prescribed opioids and got addicted that way through chronic burn pain, essentially. And Nate's story was similar. I think he injured his back at work. He used to be a roofer. Mm-hmm. And same sort of thing. He got prescribed opioids and just kept using them. And even after his prescription ran out, sort of just went to the streets and bought them and then eventually turned to heroin.
Is there is that the most common path to this sort of addiction? Is that Dr. Chambers is nodding his head up and down, and I can see Dr. Mangiacarne is looking a little more thoughtfully. So I'll give each of you a chance to respond to that. I'll start with Dr. Chambers and let you have the last word, Dr.
Sure. We know that when you look at opioid addictions in general, addiction to heroin is only a small portion of that total. So just even cross-sectionally, you know, most people with opioid addiction still have not done a huge amount of heroin. It's not predominantly heroin. So even from that, you know that it's starting with prescription drugs. And we also know that there's an overflow. There's huge quantities of these prescription drugs that have been prescribed. And, you know, in most cases, anecdotally, at least in my clinic, the vast majority of patients were initially prescribed them for some indication in the course of healthcare. We also have other data showing that there's a relationship in Indiana between the rates of addiction, addiction treatment service needs, and access to healthcare and clinics. Moreover, there's even some data that we've come up with that we've observed in Indianapolis showing that there's even some types of health insurance that put people at risk for acquiring prescription opioid addiction.
Dr. Mangiacarne.
Now, I certainly want to expound a little bit on what Dr. Chambers is saying. There is a strong, there's a lot of people that fall into that category, but there's also a number of people that are using somebody else's prescription opioids, and that's how they get started. It could be a teenager who finds some Vicodin in the cabinet that mom and dad had from a surgery they may have had months ago, and sometimes they get started that way. So the prescriptions, the opioids have been overprescribed greatly. I mean, there's enough opioids to provide every adult person in the United States a bottle of Vicodin to take every 4 hours around the clock for a week. But again, they don't always get started for the patient. Sometimes it's a family member or a friend that goes into the medicine cabinet.
How did we get to, I got to say, if that number, yeah. I mean, you probably saw I was lifting my eyebrows. How did we get to that number? I mean, that's flood tide, basically.
Well, again, there's a lot of things that factored into this. I mean, one of the things was when the Joint Commission came out and said that pain was the fifth vital sign, and you had to ask every patient about pain at every hospital encounter. And there was a lot of when OxyContin came onto the market, and there was a lot of marketing around. Some of it was not forthright, and they mentioned that, you know, it wasn't that addictive. And, you know, a lot of, you know, family doctors, I'm a family doctor by training, we didn't get that information that it was very powerfully addictive, and it took lots of cases and to find out how problematic this was.
How and Dr. Chambers, I'm going to throw this one back to you. Picking up on that phrase, powerfully addictive, I mean, how addictive are these? How quickly can someone become addicted to these opioids?
Well, it's a great question. The truth is that addiction is a disease, and like virtually all diseases, there is differential vulnerability to the disease, you know, and it could range widely. You know, you could have an individual who could be prescribed hydrocodone for 2 weeks and for a post-surgical situation, and they use those meds appropriately and they stop using them and all's fine. You know, there are other individuals who you give them hydrocodone for 1 week and you have created a lifelong disease that's going to kill them. That is just an example of the range that's possible. And we also know what some of those risk factors are for that range. The two that come to mind for me that's actually part of what we're studying very intensively at IU is, number one, mental illness. Mental illness is a huge risk factor, and we believe that's very biological. That's not a choice issue. And secondly is adolescence or young adulthood. There's something different about the brain in an adolescent compared to an adult that makes the adolescent much more vulnerable to acquiring addiction. So we actually even think that there could be some similar themes in the brain that's happening in mental illness and adolescence that set them both up for acquiring addiction much more rapidly. Addiction is a biological process. It's a disease process. And we are just now beginning to get a hold of the risk factors that, you know, would also include genetics and some other factors I didn't mention.
If you are just joining us, we are continuing our conversation about opioid addiction in Indiana, and particularly the hard road to recovery that many Hoosiers have when they want to get clean. My guests are Jake Harper, who is WFYI side effects reporter, Dr. Andy Chambers of Indiana University's Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarney, who is medical director for Fairbanks Nonprofit Alcohol and Drug Treatment Center. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. On No Limits today, we are continuing our conversation about opioid addiction in Indiana and focusing particularly on the struggle many Hoosiers have to find their way back to recovery. My guests are Jake Harper. He is WFYI side effects reporter, Dr. Andy Chambers of Indiana University's Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarney, who is medical director at Fairbanks. Before we went to the break, we were talking about how addiction really takes place, and I don't think it would be responsible on our part not to ask what some of the signs are, because doubtless from the sounds of it, there are probably people listening to this program right now who are taking these drugs for pain or some other circumstance and might not even be aware that they could be getting themselves into trouble. So what are some of the signs that an addiction might be taking root? Dr. Mangiacarney, I'll start with you, but I want to hear both of your thoughts on this.
Well, there's a couple things. If you're really looking forward to the next dose and you're counting down the time you need until you can take that next dose, that's a sign. If you find out that the medications that you're taking are not working as well as they used to, if you end up taking more pills than were originally prescribed, if you run out of pills before, you know, your prescription is up, these are all telltale signs that, you know, the prescription and the opiates may be causing a problem for you.
Dr. Chambers?
That's well said. I mean, you know, this disease impacts the part of the brain that controls motivation. So I see it as a disorder of motivational control in the brain. So you become really motivated to line up your next dose. You know, patients really feel the urge, and it doesn't necessarily, it's not logical. It doesn't really tie itself to any actual or practical purpose. It's just a burning urge and desire for that next dose. And, you know, over time as the disease progresses, they begin to sacrifice their other natural motivations, you know, their work, their relationships, their education. They start, you know, doing all kinds of things that starts tearing down their normal behavioral repertoires, their normal behaviors and lifestyle. And they devote more and more, you know, the addiction is a term, you know, kind of an ancient term that kind of relates to the term slavery. And I think that's really, the ancients were right on this. It really is kind of like a form of slavery once you become addicted, because you're doing things you really wouldn't normally want to do. And you begin to, you know, different people can see it at different points as it's progressing in themselves. But that's kind of what it's like.
That's interesting, because in literature, that's actually one of the cliches they use to refer to addiction, is that you've become subject to a cruel master.
Right.
So it connects back. Jake, you alluded in the piece that we started this with, the story about the Turners, about how it affected Mrs. Turner's ability to, you know, care for their child. It affected Mr. Turner's ability to find and hold on to a job. Could you talk a little bit about the impact that you see in the reporting on people's lives and their work?
Yeah, sure. Well, so the impact there was mainly due to their use of a drug called buprenorphine or Suboxone is the brand name. And that allows them to sort of control their cravings. And the doctors certainly know more about this than I do, but it keeps them from seeking, at least it's part of the reason they don't go out daily to seek heroin or other opioid painkillers that they had been using. And that's how it enabled Angela to sort of take better care of their daughter when before she might have been more focused, as Andy was talking about, on finding those drugs. And the same thing for Nate. He sort of struggled keeping a job, and now that he's on buprenorphine, he's able to sort of hold that down more easily, I guess.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about opioid addiction in Indiana, and particularly the hard road to recovery that many Hoosiers have to travel. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Justin has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Justin, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, I just want to thank you for the topic. It's such an important topic. And to the physicians that you have on the show, they've shared such valuable information. In October of 2013, my son Aaron was 20 years old, and he overdosed on heroin. And since that time, I've been working very hard to address the current opioid, I like to call, crisis in Indiana by helping us better understand these challenges that physicians have mentioned, and helping families and providing the overdose reversal drug naloxone. So it's the one key piece, we believe, to continue to help the individual towards recovery. We also have been working on educating young people about the dangers in regards to experimenting with these drugs. One of the doctors mentioned, and I don't remember whom, I'm sorry, how young people are also finding it in medicine cabinets, and they're sharing other people's prescriptions. And I will say that is one of the ways Aaron got started on his opioid addiction. However, he also was prescribed pain medicine, and his brain, I believe, is one of those brains that enjoy the feeling as opposed to some of us who don't. And we know that there's research that shows that young people prescribed opioids under the age of 15 are much more likely to develop that substance use problem later in life. So I would hope maybe we could talk about that a little bit, the importance of knowing how to properly take the medication and understanding that every 4 to 6 hours doesn't mean every 4 to 6 hours if you don't have pain anymore.
Thank you very much for this call, and please accept my sympathies on the loss of your son. I really appreciate you sharing your story with us, and we will talk about it. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly. Well, some of this we have dealt with already, but it bears repeating, clearly. Dr. Mangiacarne, I'm going to let you have the first word, but I want to hear Dr. Chambers' thoughts as well.
Well, certainly my heart goes out to you hearing the story about your son. And, you know, Narcan, we know, is a reversal it's an antidote for opiate overdose. And Narcan saves lives, and the more access to Narcan, whether we can put it into the police, the fire department, have it on all the ambulances, I mean, and Narcan is available by prescription, and I believe there are some pharmacies that you can actually buy it without a prescription. It comes in a couple of different flavors. There's an Evzio, which is a FDA-approved, and it is an auto-injecting kit that you can get. Kind of walks you through step-by-step, paddles on a defibrillator. There's also kits that are made that are intranasal that you can squirt into the nostril of a patient. Narcan is so helpful and so effective. And the key is, after somebody gets Narcan, is sending them into treatment. I mean, right now we still see a lag in patients that get Narcan and aren't getting the follow-up care and the follow-up treatment because, you know, just saving their lives does not mean that, you know, that they're okay to go. They still need care. They still need treatment. They still need medical services.
We've sort of, I'm going to reframe this question just a little bit for Dr. Chambers. We've alluded to it in the conversation, but we probably ought to talk about what medication-assisted treatment is and how it works, because that's really sort of what we're talking about here, is rather than what the difference is between it and abstinence programs and all of that. Dr. Chambers?
Sure. You know, if I might, just for a second, you know, the whole concept of calling it medication-assisted treatment, you know, it's a very popular term. Everybody pretty much knows what that is. It just means, you know, using medications to treat addiction as well as other psychotherapies. And I think what's striking to me about that term and its, you know, advent in the last couple of years is that, you know, to me, it's the term exists because simply because addiction has not been thought of as a disease. Like we don't say you know, medication assisted treatment of diabetes or medication assisted or you know, medication assisted treatment of you know, a pneumonia. Oh my gosh, you know, wild. You know, so to me, it's you know, kind of significant for that. It just means that we have not been thinking of addiction as a disease. We've been thinking of it as a criminal problem. And I've built a massive criminal justice system around that idea instead of a treatment infrastructure. So anyway, you know, medication-assisted treatment is a host of medications, and we have more than one to treat multiple, you know, different types of addiction. And these are, you know, evidence-based treatments that have undergone, you know, rigorous clinical trials and FDA approval for the treatment of addictions, and that should be used, you know, in line with healthcare, you know, should be used with physicians' expertise, with diagnosis, evaluation, you know, testing at the initiation of treatment to measure efficacy, and that, you know, these kinds of treatments should go along with, they should be integrated with psychotherapies for addiction as well. So, you know, in a way, it's kind of like MAT is actually saying, hey, addiction is a disease and it belongs in the house of medicine, just like cancer treatment or heart disease treatment.
Let me, I want to, you raised an important subject that I do want us to dive into, whether the whole premise of dealing with addiction by treating it largely as a criminal justice problem rather than a medical problem isn't part of what got us to the point we're at. But as a baby step toward getting into that larger conversation, I want to talk to some of the issues that Justin raised and that were alluded to in Jake's reporting, and that is the obstacles that are in the path of getting to recovery, the difficulty of getting these prior authorizations, perhaps not having emergency and law enforcement personnel trained or equipped with the kind of medication that they might use. What are some first steps we could take to make it easier for these folks who want to find their way back onto the road to recovery? I'm going to start with Dr. Chambers on that one.
For me, there's really three legs of the stool. One leg is you have to have a professionally trained physician workforce. Unfortunately, that is diminishingly rare in Indiana. We really need to train more physicians, more psychiatrists, more primary care doctors in this area. Number two is we have to have actual places to practice. You know, there has to be a physical infrastructure, you know, embedded in clinics, in hospitals. And, you know, it's just shocking how siloed off behavioral health is from general health care, general medical care, how so many of our big hospitals have so little addiction treatment offering at all inside them. The third piece is you gotta pay for it on par with other types of health care. You know, that's called parity, deciding that, you know, parity is saying that, you know, the treatment of brain diseases needs to be supported by insurance companies and by the medical establishment on par with the way we treat the heart or the way we treat the liver. You can't skimp on one. and decide arbitrarily that the other set of diseases are the kinds that we're going to treat. Because if you do that, you end up actually causing disease to pop up in other places and for those diseases to be actually much more expensive to treat.
Dr. Mangiacarne.
Dr. Chambers is very, very eloquent in what he had to say. Again, the integration of primary care and behavioral health is one of the things that can be done. Too far, too long. Addiction has been on the fringes of medicine, and it has not been welcomed into the house of medicine. Again, addiction has not been treated as a disease for far too long. And so doing that. And then as far as the insurance companies goes, these prior authorizations, they make you jump through every hoop possible to get the care that you need. If you can you have a patient that's ready and they want treatment now and you want to prescribe them buprenorphine, something that can save their lives, the insurance company wants to do a prior auth. They may not pay for it for 5 to 7 days. And during that 5 to 7 day period, the patient, doesn't have access to medication. They could go over and relapse and use heroin and overdose and die. These things have to be, made brought to the forefront so our patients get the care they need when they need it, because they may not want it a week from now. They want it when they're ready. You have to pounce on it when they're ready.
We've gotten a comment from a listener on Facebook, and if you'd like to find us on Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. This is from Terry. It says, I have chronic pain, fibromyalgia, and sacral problems with my back. My access to painkillers since the late 90s has improved my quality of life tremendously. I do come from a genetic background of addiction, but can space out my pills further than prescribed. I am very wary of hearing about how limiting the use of this very helpful medication can be. We probably ought to make the case that these painkillers are not necessarily evil incarnate, that they are a tool that can be used, but like many tools, can be misused. Dr. Mangiacarne.
Well, again, I can't say anything about this particular case without having all of the details. And again, what we know about opiates, chronic long-term opiates do not improve the function for patients over long periods of time. Over time, they make pain worse, and patients' functions decline over time. These medications were indicated for acute care models. They were FDA approved under noxious stimuli testing, not for chronic pain testing. There's a host of non-opioid pharmacological tools that are available for patients that have chronic pain of what we consider non-benign origin. So I would certainly encourage you to anyone who this would fall under to maximize all of the non-narcotic routes of pain control.
Jake, are there some medications that are more overprescribed than others? What are the sort of the ones that you ought to be worrying about the most?
I think the doctors would be better at answering this, but I think OxyContin is well known as being like one of the primary one of the early starters of this epidemic that we're experiencing now, but
Dr. Chambers,
they'd be better at this.
Well, it is the case that different opioids have different potencies, which means that in different ways they get into your body, and that affects, all their psychoactive profiles, their addiction risk, et cetera. However, I think that in some ways, it's better to lump them together than it is to separate them out, because, you can start an addiction on a mild opioid just as much as you can on a very potent one. I think the potent ones are, more liable to a lethal overdose situation, but I think even the mild ones can certainly lead to an addiction under the right circumstances.
Are there some that are just more addictive than others? The ones that you really, Dr. Mangiacarne, real quickly.
I don't know if there are some that are more addictive than others. This is a brain disease and a brain illness, and if you have the disease, any opioid acting on the brain receptors can have that effect.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about opioid addiction in Indiana, and particularly the hard road people have to cover to recovery. My guests are Jake Harper of WFYI and Side Effects, Dr. Andy Chambers of the Indiana University Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarne, who is Medical Director for Fairbanks. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about continuing our conversation about opioid addiction in Indiana and focusing particularly on the hard road to recovery that many Hoosiers have, including having to work past some obstacles that the system puts in their way. My guests are Jake Harper of WFYI and Side Effects, who's done some marvelous reporting on this issue and story, Dr. Andy Chambers, who is with the Indiana University Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Darren Mangiacarney, who is medical director for Fairbanks. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Brandy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brandy, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I'm calling. I have struggled with addiction for about 10, 12 years since the birth of my first daughter, which I had by cesarean, which they prescribed me pain medication. And ever since then, I had had problems with it. So I, about 5 years ago, I went to the methadone clinic here in Indianapolis. I had originally went there for Suboxone treatment, but because the price was higher than the methadone, I opted to go the route of the methadone. My insurance, I work, it's been great. It's totally changed my life, my family's life. But the methadone wasn't in the insurance's, the insurance didn't cover it. Okay. It was out of network. So I, instead of having to pay for insurance, I have to pay for the methadone, which is like $5,500 a year. So I just, that's a problem that I run into, kind of a conflict of, do I get insurance or do I get the treatment that helps me get through life each day? And I just thank you for putting this on air and letting people know about the struggles that people are having with it.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, and really no need to thank us. That's what we're here for. That's what we're supposed to do, is have these kinds of conversations. So thank you very much for sharing your story. Dr. Chambers.
Yes. I think her point is really important and exemplifies the lack of parity that we're facing. If I want to use methadone, which is an opioid, and I want to prescribe it, I can do that. Any doctor can do that, and it will be covered by insurance. My time with a patient will be covered by insurance. Insurance company will pay me for my time. The insurance company will pay for the methadone, and I can prescribe almost any amount of it. The catch is it has to be a diagnosis of pain. If, on the other hand, the diagnosis is addiction and the methadone now is being used to protect that person from other types of opiates that are far more dangerous, that is not covered at all by insurance in Indiana, not government insurance, not private insurance. To me, that should be illegal. That violates federal health care parity.
Has there ever been, and I'll ask all three of you this, has there been litigation on that issue or question? Silence doesn't work on radio.
I'm not that I know of it, certainly not in Indiana that I know of. There may have been elsewhere in the country. There may have been litigation around this, but I don't know how often the federal health care parity rules have actually been enforced, or that suits have been brought around that. I think there are a few cases in the Northeast where some professionals are banded together because they're being blocked from providing addiction care. But I think bringing litigation takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of time and resources, and the people in need often don't have resources. You're not going to be able to hire high-powered attorneys, a team of high-powered attorneys, it's going to be required to take on a state government, for example, or an insurance company very readily based on the resources that collection of patients might have.
Yeah, so there's actually – so in 2008, there was a law passed known informally as the Parity Rule or Parity Law. The formal name is Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act. It's the law that's the law that Andy's referring to. And there's it's basically to sort of shore up these differences between how medical care is handled and how mental illness and addiction is handled by the insurers. But there's no one that's really assigned with enforcement of this. So there have been improvements made since that law came into effect, but the sort of the prior authorizations and other treatment limitations that are harder to sort of see that and they don't have numbers attached to them are harder to enforce. And so that's sort of the issue with these prior authorizations and other things that we're seeing now.
We're starting to get lots of emails and calls here, so I'm gonna try to be brief getting through these and to ask that we try to be as brief as possible in answering them. This one comes from a listener named John, and again, if you want to send us an email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. It says, my question is regarding the receptors in the brain that give the pleasure high sensation that leads to addiction. Are those receptors the same that block pain? And if not, is there a medicine that can be administered concomitantly or prior to opioid dosing that may interfere with forming addictions? Since we talk about reactive responses with meds, is there a proactive option? I'm assuming, Jake, probably that is one we ought to throw to the doctors.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
All right.
Well, again, the receptor on the brain that's involved in most of these opioids is the mu receptor, and the mu receptor is what causes most of the opioid effects, including the pain relief and the pleasurability. There's some recent research that they're doing out in UCLA as far as making opiates non-habit forming. There's a couple of polymorphisms that they found. I mean, these things are years from coming to the market, but there's people doing some work on that. But as for currently, there's really nothing that you can do to take prior to taking an opiate to make the opiate less less beneficial, less pleasurable.
I've also gotten an email question from a listener named Eric, who refers to me as Mr. Crawl. Eric, if you listen to this program, you can call me John. We're friends. With the stigmatization of addiction and other behavioral health issues, what are positive steps individuals can take to break down attitudes about who deserves treatment? How can we move our state politics to mirror new attitudes about behavioral health? Jake, I'm going to give you, since you cover these issues, what are some ways that we might break down the stigma associated with addiction?
What I hear a lot as a journalist is sort of the words that we use to refer to addiction to a substance such as opioids. You hear a lot of people use the term clean versus not clean, I guess, or using. In sort of that, I've heard that that's sort of an issue in terms of stigmatizing the problem, as well as even the term addict, I think, has some negative connotations now that people tend to associate negatively. And I think so. I mean, from my perspective, that's mainly what I hear. I'm sure other people have other things that they could help.
In terms of dealing with this, what are some changes in the way that we deal with this as a question of law that would help these folks along the path to recovery? I'll start with you, Dr. Mangiacarney.
Well, again, one of the things that I do is I try to tell all of my patients that refer to yourselves as a person in recovery, not someone with or suffering from the disease of addiction. I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a druggie. There's all kinds of negative things that people say. Government is becoming much more open to this again, with the Narcan being available now. Again, but it's still a lot of effort, a lot of work. I mean, we've made progress. We absolutely have, but we still have a lot of work to go on this.
Dr. Chambers.
Sure, I would agree. I think, certainly the language we use is a factor, but you can change a term for something and still not really change the stigma. And sooner or later, the new term you've chosen gets stigmatized, and you've never really addressed the stigma. You just keep changing words. We go through that all the time in psychiatry with different mental illnesses. And, you know, I do think that it's more about whatever term you're picking, make sure that everybody really understands it, what it's referring to, and how current strategies of addressing it or the way we misunderstand what that term represents is really causing massive domestic problems, both financial in this country as well as health related. And I think that, you know, when you begin to really look into what is going on with addiction and how many tendrils this disease has in our society, how many tentacles it reaches into in terms of our economics, in terms of how we treat each other, the quality of life, crime, our healthcare crisis, the fact that the United States spends double than any other Western country, but our outcomes are worse across the board. How does that relate to what's going on with addiction? How does mass incarceration relate to that? I think when people start really looking into what's going on here, and you really get to a point where, you know, you realize, oh my gosh, there's some really profound things that need to change. I think that's what I encourage people to do is, you know, continue to read. I think the media has been doing, you know, media in Indianapolis, you guys, you know, have been doing a great job. The media around the country has been doing a great job, doing its job to educate the public on this. I do think that politicians should be vetted for their understanding and views on this stuff. I think that there has to be a little bit of a conversation to go on about, you know, what is this ultimately a criminal problem or is it a disease problem, and what are the cost benefits of approaching it one way or the other?
Our listeners, Terry and Ursula, Terry, who we had a Facebook comment from earlier, and Ursula are having a fascinating conversation on our Facebook page right now, where Ursula said that, you know, physical therapy and massages, for example, might be a conservative way to deal with pain. And Terry came back and said, presumably accurately, that it would be wonderful, but insurance often won't pay for massages and physical therapy, that it's easier to get medicated. Is there, very, very briefly, because we've got a couple more callers I want to try to get to here, is some of it that, you know, in terms of dealing with pain, we don't reimburse or will not pay for, the insurance companies will not pay for the means that are less threatening or less intrusive? Dr. Mangiacarney.
I mean, that's certainly part of it. And we do know that, you know, physical therapy is very helpful, as is biofeedback, relaxation, all these other strategies, non-pharmacologic, are very helpful for pain. And the other thing is your average family doctor, you know, who has to see 25 or 30 patients a day, has 15 minutes in the exam room with the patient. And, you know, the patient's complaining of pain, and you don't have a whole lot of time. You want to make the patient happy. And a lot of times it's easier to write them a script than it is to have a long conversation, especially when the waiting room is full.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about Indiana's continuing problem with opioid addiction. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you gentlemen doing today?
We're doing very well. We're getting a little tight on time, so I'm going to ask you to get to your question as quickly as possible.
Right away.
Thank you.
10 years ago, all I could read was Purdue Pharmaceutical was saying OxyContin was great for pain. I had a back injury at 57. And this beeping you're hearing is the Narcan. I was prescribed Narcan when I was on 50 milligrams of OxyContin. I have since dwindled down to 10 and will be off this week. But this Narcan right here, I'm trying to pull the trainer off just so you can hear it.
Outer thigh. Then yeah. Press firmly and hold in place for 5 seconds. Five, four, three, two. One. Injection complete.
Wow.
That's the Narcan. I was prescribed that at 10 milligrams, which, of course, went on my insurance records. And that's the injector right there. I cannot believe that doctors are now forced to write this after we were told that pain medicine was good for us. Now I'm bedridden again at age 65 because I'm on no pain medicine. And here I sit with this Narcan unit, which costs $5,000. That's my question.
All right. Jeff, thank you very much for the call, and we are sorry for your troubles. Thanks. Well, we probably ought to talk about the human cost here. We've talked about the larger global problem here. But literally, Jeff's story is one of someone, you know, I'm not sure which was the fire and which was the frying pan, but he's been bouncing and back and forth between the two. Dr. Chambers.
Well, you know, I think one of the important things to remember in this case, and also some others, you know, from other callers, is that, you know, unfortunately, healthcare is a human endeavor, and it's susceptible to fads and fashions and, you know, buzzwords and, you know, all kinds of novelty that can drive the field sometimes in the wrong direction. And it can take us a long time to pull it back. But I also think that, you know, the other thing, too, is that, you know, we talked about MAT here, you know, and Suboxone and Methadone. But, you know, it's also important to realize that these are just tools. And you know what? We could take those in the wrong direction as well. You know, we could use those treatments and be over-exuberant about it and forget that it actually takes physician expertise. It takes teamwork. It takes psychotherapy. It takes a multidisciplinary approach. You know, if we get too over-invested in these tools, we could end up right back up into the same problem. I think it's a matter of nuance. You know, any one thing we take on, you can't over-idealize it and assume it's the next new answer and so push it 100%. Everything we do in medicine has a downside, and there has to be a nuanced approach to this, and the people who do that are well-trained physicians in their area of care.
I'm going to ask this because we've gotten a lot, just a flood of questions and comments coming in here at the very end, and we're literally about 90 seconds away from having to sign off. I'm going to ask our listeners if they would direct their questions to our Facebook page, which is No Limits WFYI, and ask our three guests if you would be able to hang around for, say, 15 minutes after the end of the broadcast to take the questions and deal with them as best you can. Recognizing, of course, and I'll say this so the doctors don't have to, they can't diagnose you. They cannot prescribe anything for you without actually seeing you and you being a patient of theirs. Would you be willing to do that?
I'd be very happy to.
Me too.
Dr. Chambers, Jake?
Sure. I work here.
This is good. This is good. Give us some sign of hope here. I mean, are there places where we are turning the corner? I'm going to give Dr. Mangiacarni, I'm going to give you the last word in about 10 seconds.
We are making a lot of progress in this illness. We have lots of other, we have a buprenorphine implant that just came out. There's a buprenorphine injection once a week that's coming out. We are making progress. But again, as Dr. Chambers would say, it's a multidisciplinary approach. It's not one bullet for one patient. We have a lot of other tools that have to be used. But this is a treatable illness.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests and invite everybody to come back on Tuesday. We're going to be talking with Republican Senate candidate Todd Young. I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.